It's certainly great to see everybody here. We are in Mark chapter 15, and hopefully we'll be able to finish Mark chapter 15. We have the last few moments of Jesus's life on earth before his crucifixion, obviously before his resurrection, and his burial that we are going to look at today. So let us consider the next section here. We read it last time, but we didn't go over it very much because we were running out of time. But let us consider the next section is his final moments. His final moments, verses 39 or 37 through 39. Let us read that now. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. Then the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. So when the centurion who stood opposite him saw that he cried out like this and breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." And so this is the moment where Jesus dies. We note earlier that he was being mocked. He was being mocked up on that cross. The things that we had covered already, he was taken to Golgotha, taken to the place of the skull, Calvary is what Luke calls it. He was lifted up on that cross, and he endured even more mockery than we could possibly think of, adding insult to injury while he's up there hanging on that cross and suffering and dying. And as we see in this section, these last few moments, there are some things to consider. As we had considered earlier in verse 33, that this is the ninth hour. And the way that they reckon time, this is the about 9 or rather 3 p.m., about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, of course, they didn't reckon time as precisely as we do, so we can say this is sometime in the middle afternoon. I think that would be a safe bet there. And this is around the same time that the Passover lamb was killed. Now, this is assuming, if you had been following along in the class while we were doing it online, when we went over Mark chapter 14, the earlier part of the first few verses of that, when we consider the timing of this, and that would make this the 14th of Nisan, which is the first month of the Jewish calendar, and this is after the captivity. They changed the names of their months after the Babylonian captivity. When they returned, they retained more Babylonian names to their months. And so Nisan is the first one here in where the Passover happens. And so this is their religious calendar that they had. And so that would make this then the year AD 33. Now, of course, there's the possibility that this is the day after the 15th of Nisan, which would make this AD 30. So that is, some people like to know about when these things happened, and it's good to know and have that in our mind that these are real dates, these are real times, and we can figure out a day, or a year rather, based on the day of the week that this happened. And so we have that here. Christ is, of course, regardless of whether or not he died on the 14th or the 15th of Nisan, we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7. Will somebody read that? I know we haven't done that in a while where somebody would read a passage like that. Would somebody read that for us? If you're following along online, you can turn to that passage and read it for yourself.
1 Corinthians 5, 7?
Yes.
Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new one, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us.
All right. So Christ is our Passover. He was sacrificed for us. And so we can find that to be very much the case here in this particular event happening right now. All right. And then, let's see if I can bookmark. There we go. All right. So he is the Passover lamb. One of the terrible things about crucifixion is that given the posture, the general posture that someone is in whenever they are being crucified, it's difficult to exhale without pushing on your legs to do so. While you're hanging up on that cross, then it's you need to push up on your legs in order to breathe out. And that's not something that we generally experience because how many of us have been in that position before? One of the most excruciating, literally, things to consider when we consider someone dying on a cross in that fashion. No doubt, the jagged wood of the cross, because I doubt they really sanded that thing, do you? Do you think they sanded that cross down? Very unlikely. And so while the splintery wood is digging into his back, he's got to lift himself up, and he's been scourged horribly beforehand. And so he's dealing with that pain and that agony. And then this loud voice that he cries out with here in verse 37, it would have been very difficult for him to have done that. Because, man, if you're going to cry out with a loud voice, you've got to be able to exhale. You've got to be able to breathe out. And that how difficult that is under these circumstances. But our Lord, he let one out. He let out this loud scream. Now, it doesn't say what that scream was or what he yelled out here in Mark, but we understand in John chapter 19 and verse 30, what he cried out was, "It is finished. It is accomplished. He's done what he's needed to do. He has fulfilled his purpose statements," right? The purpose statements that we talked about all the way back in Mark chapter 1, where we started talking about that. Another purpose statement, the primary one in the Gospel of Mark in chapter 10. His purpose in chapter 1 is to preach the gospel, is to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God, right? We also see in Mark chapter 10 that his purpose was to give his life a ransom for many. And so we see that here that it is finished. It is accomplished. He did what he set out to do. He fulfilled his mission. And so that is a remarkable, that's such an amazing thing to consider there. And then Jesus dies with this loud voice that was likely only understood by those close to him at the time. I mean, that's why John records what he said. Probably one of the reasons why John records what he says, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke do not. And so that's that may be why, because John was there at the cross near him when he died. We find that the veil of the temple was torn in two. It was torn in two, ripped from top to bottom. This was not a veil, just a little piece of cloth that you could just rip across, you know, rip apart. This was a thick piece of material. And so ripping it from the very top, it's not exactly like it was this high, right? It was high up that nobody could reach it unless they had a ladder or some scaffolding or something.
That would have been I think we studied when we measured the size of the angels that were on either side of the Holy of Holies, that they were like 15 or 16 feet tall.
Okay.
So the curtain is probably on that order, I would think. And probably made of wool, if I remember correctly, it would have been made of wool.
All right. So Sam, for the live stream, mentioned that it was probably about 15 or 20 feet high and made of wool. And so that, again, that's farther than many of us can reach. And they weren't exact. I mean, Sam might be able to reach it. But how many Jews from the first century do you think were as tall as Sam? Probably very few. Because they, you know, people generally were not as tall as they are today. Well, in any event, that's what we see. That's what we see there. All right. This is also an indication we find in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 14. This is an indication that upon Jesus' death, he tore down that middle wall of separation, that middle wall of partition. That's what we see there in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 14. That's what we see here, tearing and ripping that veil in two, which is tearing down that middle wall of separation that separated separated man from God. Now, of course, in Ephesians 2, he's talking about the separation between Jews and Gentiles. But we see that that is also an indication here in this particular event, that separation between man and God. Before the high priest was allowed entrance into this most holy place that this veil was separating. And only he, in this sense, this one time of year, had this level of access to God. Now, after Jesus has died, that access is available for us all because of what he did for us. We find in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 16 that we can now boldly approach the throne of grace. That was not something that was available to the Jews, to the Israelites back then. But that is something that's available for us. And that is because of what Jesus has done for us. The old covenant has been done away to make way for the new covenant in Christ. We find here that there are several miraculous events that surrounded Christ's death. Mark records two of them here. Of course, there are several others, especially one, a very interesting one recorded in Matthew that I'm not going to look at this time. But there are several events recorded around this time. Mark records two of them. The 3 hours of darkness that we talked about a bit last week, where it could not have been any kind of natural phenomenon. It could not have been any kind of eclipse or anything of that nature, because those things are too quick, and it's the wrong time of the month for that sort of thing. It's got to be around the time of the new moon. This is around the time of the full moon. So it's impossible for any kind of natural phenomenon to have occurred for the 3 hours of darkness. Also, this veil rent in two from top to bottom. Again, a miraculous event, something that God himself stepped in and said, "This is done. This is done." This was a clear indication who was responsible for all that was happening here. Now, of course, we might say, "Oh, well, the Romans are the ones who killed Jesus." True. It was the Jews who put him up to it. The Jewish leaders. True. But it was God's plan being carried out. God's plan being executed here. This was the purpose that Jesus had come for. So ultimately, God is the one who is behind it all. Sam?
It's interesting. Obviously, the Romans nailed him to the cross, right?
Yes.
And he was going to die on that cross, for sure. But when you look at how he died, that he had his strength, that he was able to cry out. This is, of course, you're going to talk about the centurion's opinion here in a minute. But Jesus said in another place, he says, "I have power to lay it down, and I have power to let to." And of course, as our high priest, as we studied in Hebrews, the high priest offered the lamb. And it was the high priest act that offered the lamb. And so in some sense, he was going to die on that cross one way or the other, right? But in some sense, Jesus offers himself. He decides when to die, and he does it.
Right.
He doesn't die whimpering and gasping for air.
Right. So, again, for the live stream, it was because Sam was talking about the fact that by being both high priest and sacrifice, he offered up himself. It wasn't lingering there on the cross. In fact, we're going to talk about that in a little bit when we get to a particular statement later on in this chapter. that it wasn't something that he that it wasn't he didn't just it wasn't he wasn't gasping for air. He was, well, he might have been. It doesn't say specifically, but he lets out this loud voice, and it took him a lot less time than they expected him to have passed away, to have died on the cross. And so he essentially offered himself up. And that was the remarkable another remarkable thing that we see here. This is part of his plan. I think he was buttressing the point here that I was making as well. So thank you. Then we see what the centurion thinks about all this. He witnessed Jesus. He witnessed how he died. He witnessed the darkness. He witnessed the earthquake. There's an earthquake mentioned in Matthew 27 and verse 51. He might not have just witnessed it. He might have felt it and been wondering, what is going on here? He heard. Now, this is why I mentioned this all the way back in John chapter 19 and verse 7. He heard. He was no doubt among the centurions and the soldiers there who was there. He heard the chief priests say that he made himself out to be the Son of God. And so these dots are being connected. Oh, he thinks he's the Son of God. I've heard this. This is a possibility that he thinks that this is a thing. I have seen these miracles happening surrounding this man's death. What's the conclusion? Claim? Proof? He comes to the conclusion, the right conclusion, that this man truly was the Son of God. It's a startling confession from a Gentile, a pagan. He's awestruck at the sight of all that he had witnessed that day, perhaps even the entire week, noticing that he's following Jesus along. He might have heard things here or there, seen the things that he had done, and realized, man, this obviously he's not deserving of this. Now, of course, a lot of the other soldiers were all about it. I mean, dividing his clothes and things of that nature. But this one is thinking. He heard the claim. He sees the evidence, and he comes again to that right conclusion. Unlike, no doubt, some of the other Gentile soldiers, the Roman soldiers at this time. Mark starts off the gospel with this admission in Mark chapter 1 and verse 1, saying, "This is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." That's how Mark starts this account here. He proves it with the affirmations of the Father when Jesus is baptized in Mark chapter 1 and verse 11, and at the transfiguration in Mark chapter 9 and verse 7. He confirms it with the confessions of demons, which of course Jesus is trying to quiet, trying to silence, say, "Hey, please don't do that. Please, you know, quiet down." And so, purely coincidence. Coincidental. We see that in Mark chapter 1, verse 24, Mark chapter 5, and verse 7, and in several other places, certainly. The disciples make this confession in Mark chapter 8 and verse 29. A blind beggar calls him the son of David, which is a confession of this reality in Mark chapter 10 and verse 48. And now finally this Gentile, a Roman centurion, in Mark chapter 15 and verse 39. A little bit later, we'll see the disbelief that the disciples themselves have later on in chapter 16. But who is this Jesus? That's another theme that we see here in the Gospel of Mark. Who is this Jesus? Why, he is the Holy One of God. He is the Christ. He is the Son of David. And he is the Son of God the Most High. These are all the things that are said throughout, said of Jesus by these people who are making these confessions throughout the Gospel of Mark. Who is this Jesus? Someone I want to get to know. Of course, there is no reason to think that the centurion had any concept as to the full meaning of those words. He might have thought this was, again, like we talked about Pontius Pilate, this might have been some kind of demigod like Hercules, who is half god and half man, the son of the Greek god Zeus and a human woman. While he may not have fully understood what he was saying, what he spoke was true nonetheless. Jesus was, nay, is, the Son of God. The last two verses here, or last couple of verses in this section, the women witness. The women witness what's going on here. Verses 40 and 41. There were also women looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the Less, and of Joseph and Salome, who also followed him and ministered to him when he was in Galilee, and many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. All right, these women are witnessing these events. The only ones that we see who are watching, who are supportive of Jesus, except for John, were these women. Man, you know, some people accuse the Church of Christ of treating women terribly. And boy, if we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, that certainly is not the case. That is not the case at all. They were, the women here we see in this case, they were the most supportive of Jesus and his ministry. They were the ones who were willing to be there for Jesus and take care of things, take care of the body in this, and all the things going on here. The only male disciple that we have recorded here is John. And of course, that's in the Gospel of John. It's not recorded in the other three. So the focus is on the women who are witnessing this event. These were the women, many of whom supported Jesus in his ministry. We find it mentioned here, but also in Luke chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, that it was throughout his ministry in Galilee and elsewhere that they were supporting Jesus, taking care of him, making sure that his needs were met. Mark here records Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the Less. If you have a different translation, it might say James the Younger. James the Less, and Joseph's, and Salome. So the three women here, Mary Magdalene, another Mary, and Salome. All Luke records about who these women are, we see in Luke 23, verse 49, as the women who followed him from Galilee. So it doesn't have a specific group of people that's mentioned here in Luke, although they are mentioned, several of them are mentioned in Luke 8. Including Mary Magdalene. So she ends up being very important a little bit later on. Matthew records these same women, but instead of Salome, he says the mother of Zebedee's sons, which would, of course, be James and John that we see here. So Salome then would be Zebedee's wife, unless something happened there, but understandably, this would be Zebedee and Salome had James and John. Some conclude, again, that these are the same people, and I think that makes sense. We see that in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 56. John records a couple other women there, too. Jesus's mother, Mary, and her sister. Mary, the wife of Clopas, and, of course, Mary Magdalene and John himself. We see in John 19, verse 25 and 26. So, you know, really it's speculation to try to figure out who are called the same thing, try to fit who are the same people in John's account compared to Matthew's and Mark's accounts. But there are anywhere from 4 to 7 named women witnessing this gruesome sight. Anywhere from 4 to 7 named women watching this site. Now, of course, it says in Luke there were many women, so it could have been more than that. So we see that this is not something that was a minor thing. But note here, again, Mark also says it was many other women. So it could include, from Luke chapter 8 and verse 3, Joanna, the wife of Chuza or Cusa, depending on how you pronounce that, who was Herod's steward. So we see that there in Luke chapter 8, along with a woman named Susanna. So these could very well be, again, people who are witnessing this, who are taking care of Jesus' needs earlier on in his ministry. Two of these three women listed here in Mark saw where Jesus was buried. They see where Jesus is buried. We find that in verse 47. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, observed where he was laid. Of course, we'll talk more about that later. And all three of them, we would find, would return Sunday morning after the Sabbath to anoint Jesus' body, plus a few others. We see that later on Mark 16 and Luke 24, verse 10. Mary Magdalene, let's talk about her for a second. She was a woman from a place called Magdala. This is the first time that Mark is mentioning her. So we'll talk about her for a moment because she does feature prominently later on in Mark as well. She was a woman from Magdala, which is a place on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. And we find in Luke chapter 8, verse 2, that Jesus had cast out seven demons from her. Mary, we'll look at her as well. Mary, the mother of James the Less and Joseph. Who is this particular person? Well, James the Less is often identified with James, the son of Alphaeus, being the lesser known James among the apostles. Now, is that absolutely true? No, we don't have that kind of evidence there. But that's typically who he's associated with. So there's that possibility there. Joseph is the Greek form of Joseph. So if this is James, the son of Alphaeus' mother, this Mary here, then she may also be Matthew's mother. We see in Mark chapter 2 and verse 12 that Matthew, also called Levi, is the son of Alphaeus. And so this again could be Matthew's mother as well. Salome, her name means peaceful. Peaceful. We think of shalom as well, as where the same kind of word, shalom, or Jerusalem. Salem means peace, or city of peace, peaceful. And it could be, again, as I mentioned, could be James and John's mother, the wife of Zebedee, as we see in Matthew 27, verse 56. These women stuck with Jesus up to the end. They stick with Jesus up to the end, even after almost all of the other male disciples fled. It shows us the importance and steadfastness of women in the church. Their immense value and a reminder that we can't do this without them. That women are an essential part of the Lord's church. Any comments before we go on to the burial of Jesus? Yes, Sam.
Just one. It is interesting when you look at these possible familial relationships that the mothers of a lot of the disciples and even of the apostles were actively involved in supporting the work.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we saw a little bit of that before when they said, you know, they go to so-and-so's house and you kind of connect the dots and you go like, oh, that's so-and-so's father or that's so-and-so's cousin or whatever. You know, John was related. That's how he got into the
right.
trial and got Peter in. And there's this whole family thing that we don't think about a lot. We think about these guys all coming from different places and walking and just being kind of independent. But you can imagine the women, at least from what you hear, there were quite a crowd of people who followed Jesus and the disciples around. It wasn't just Jesus walking off with the 12, you know, with nobody around for miles and miles. There were other people with him all the time.
Yeah. And that's one thing that I think should be emphasized sometimes whenever we are looking at these gospel accounts. We note that it's not just these 12 people walking around with them. It's a whole group of people, including the women. We note another instance, of course, where the mother of James and John, which could very well be the same Salome, tries to ask Jesus about having James and John being have high positions in the kingdom of God. And so we see that that thing there as well earlier on in the same instance is recorded in Matthew and Mark. I can't remember off the top of my head which one mentions the mother. but we do see that earlier on. All right. So thank you, Sam. So for those I did repeat that. So we're good.
You did good.
All right. Next, let's consider the burial of Jesus. Jesus is buried. Mark chapter 15, verses 42 through 47. Let's read. Now when evening had come, because it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent council member, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, coming and taking courage, went in to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate marveled that he was already dead. And summoning the centurion, he asked him if he had been dead for some time. So when he found out from the centurion, he granted the body of Joseph. Then he brought fine linen, took him down, and wrapped him in the linen. And he laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of the rock, and rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. And Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Joseph, observed where he was laid. All right. Let's consider the timing here. Mark says that evening had come. This is an indication that this was late in the afternoon. Of course, this is after 3 p.m. or so. So this is in between 3 and 6 o'clock, and there's a reason why that's important, why it's 6 o'clock. It was, of course, the preparation day. This was Friday, and in fact, at some point, this very word, preparation day, became synonymous with the word Friday. And so this is Friday happening at this particular moment. It was preparation day. Again, this is Friday, the day before the Sabbath, when they had to prepare to not work. Of course, in the Sabbath, they had a lot of restrictions on what they could and they could not do. And so on Friday, they had to prepare meals, they had to prepare, accommodate for different things to make sure that they could rest on the Sabbath day, to make sure everything was in order. So that was the preparation day. They had just a few hours to prepare for sundown when the Sabbath had come. So they didn't have a whole lot of time to prep everything, to prep to prep the body and to prep for themselves for the Sabbath the next day. So there was a lot of things going on in these last few hours of daylight. Because again, the Sabbath day began 6 o'clock in the evening on Friday. All right, so let's consider Joseph of Arimathea here. Who is this person? Well, based on this verse and his mentions in the other gospel accounts, we still don't really know a whole lot about this particular man. He is from Arimathea. Well, where is that? The location is unknown today. We still are not entirely sure where Arimathea is. Though some people identify it with Ramah, or Ramah, from the Old Testament, the home of the prophet Samuel. And so we see that, of course, in the book of 1 Samuel, where he's from. And it's also in the ancestral area of Ephraim. So we see that there. That's possibly where he's from. He was a member of the council, a member of the Sanhedrin, who did not consent to Jesus' crucifixion. We see in Luke chapter 23, verses 50 and 51. He did not consent to that. He didn't want that to happen. Ironically, since it was a rule that one could not be executed if everyone on the council voted guilty, that was evidence of a conspiracy, then he may have been the one who allowed them to vote or allowed them to follow this one rule out of the many that they had broken. Remember, we had talked about several weeks ago during the trial that many of the rules that they had for the trials had been broken. There were, what, 20-some rules, I think, that they had broken for this trial. And some of them are from the Old Testament law, and some of them are things that they had come up with since then. And so they had broken so many rules. Well, this might have been one that they didn't have to break if Joseph voted against the crucifixion of this man. We find that he was a rich man. He was a rich man. And this would factor into prophecy, as we'll see. We note that he was rich. We see in Matthew 27 and verse 57. He was a secret disciple. We note he was a secret disciple of Jesus for fear of the Jews. We see that in John 19, verse 38. No doubt the fear was of his elite peers on the council, since the common people loved him. Right? We note that the common people, they just adored Jesus. And so he was a man who was afraid of losing his position or being thought of differently or something. Who knows exactly what the reasons were for being a secret disciple. He may have even been one of the ones described earlier in John chapter 12, verse 42 and 43. And it mentions there that there were some there who believed but would not confess him. Why? Because they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. So there is that possibility. He may have been among those people, not wanting to be kicked out of the synagogue, which is another possibility there. The one who has as much to lose, the one who has much to lose, should he go out on a limb like that? So if you have a lot to lose, you go out on a limb, it's possible that you lose it all. You have more to lose in that situation. And Joseph of Arimathea was one of them. He was willing to come out and do the right thing now, along with his friend and fellow believer among the elite, Nicodemus. Now, it doesn't say that here in Mark, but in John chapter 19 and verse 39, Nicodemus joined him in this burial. I guess better late than never, huh? Better late than never. Of course, we see in hindsight, it was not too late, as Joseph's name is known to all Christians and recorded in all four of the gospel accounts. Let's see, do I have time to consider the... Let's consider this request, and then we'll close out. There's one more thing after this, but let's consider the request here, because I think it's pretty interesting. As we discussed earlier, in the Old Testament, bodies were not permitted to stay hanging on a tree for longer than a day. We find that in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 22 through 23. They're not permitted to stay on the cross or hanging from a tree for longer than a day. Normally, the Romans would leave up crucified individuals for as long as possible to stand as a warning to others. But they often deferred to local laws and customs. And of course, this was in the Old Testament law, an ancient law at this point. And so they may have abided by that, and likely abided by that typically. And the reason for doing that is so that they could help keep the peace at this time. Because, of course, the Jews were very... it was a bit of a powder keg there in Palestine, even then. And so they were trying to keep the peace there, and so we see that that may have been one of the reasons why they deferred to that custom. But we find that Pilate was still amazed that Jesus had already died. He was amazed that Jesus had already died. Depending on how a condemned man was crucified, it could take anywhere from days to 10 minutes, 10 minutes to days to die on the cross, depending on how he was crucified. 10 minutes to days. Amazing. In fact, that's how we know that at least one Jehovah's Witness teaching is false. Because one of the ways that they insist that Jesus was crucified was on a what they call a torture stake, which is having his hands up above his head in the fashion that you see on the picture up there. And that's how they insist he must have died in that way on the cross. They believe that Jesus crucified like this. They are rather insistent about it too. I don't think it's one of their core doctrines, but it is something that they really like to say, oh, y'all Christians, y'all don't know what y'all are talking about. This is how he was crucified. Well, the problem with this view is that if Jesus were crucified like this, he would not have lasted 6 hours. It would have been impossible. This is one of those times where it would have taken him about 10 minutes to die. And clearly the Bible records that it was 6 hours, and Pilate was surprised that he died so soon. Why would Pilate be so surprised if he were crucified like this and it would have just taken 10 minutes? Ooh. That particular, 10 minutes, anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes, according to this Jeremy Ward, a physiologist at King's College in London. So he knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to that kind of thing, crucifixions and such, and what it's like for someone to undergo that sort of thing. Pilate would not have been shocked had Jesus been crucified in this way, that Jesus was dead already. Someone nailed to a cross would have lasted no more than 24 hours. Which explains why Pilate was so surprised that Jesus was dead for only 6 hours. Sometimes they're nailed to the cross. Sometimes they're tied. And if they're tied on there with a rope, then they could last days. But if they're nailed, they typically don't last more than 24 hours. And so only 6 hours? Pilate's thinking, how is that even possible? How is that even possible? He expected Jesus to have needed some help dying, as the thieves on the cross on either side did. They had their legs broken so that they could be taken down before sundown. The legs broken, as I mentioned earlier, they needed their legs to push up so that they could exhale. Well, if their legs are broken, they can't do that anymore, and they end up suffocating. And so that is what is expected of what was expected of Jesus. We see in John chapter 19, verses 31 through 33. Pilate was so shocked, he asked his centurion to go check it out. Wait a second, that can't be right. Go check that out. Make sure he's dead. And of course, we understand in John that he was pierced in his side afterwards. When it was confirmed that Jesus had actually been dead, according to this, for some time, we note that because the blood and water came out when he was pierced. That kind of thing only happens when you've been dead for a little bit. Pilate grants the body to be given to Joseph. So, I don't want to leave you. This did not happen like this. I don't want to leave you with that image, so that's a lot closer to what it looked like. It's a lot closer to what it looked like. Yes, Sam.
The other, common objection is the swoon theory. Jesus didn't really die, and they conned him to let him off the cross easy and before he died, et cetera, et cetera. The big thing, the big flaw in that one, is a centurion is an expert in death, absolute expert. To reach the level of centurion, you would have been in battles where thousands of people had died. And you had probably killed hundreds of people yourself.
Yeah.
He was an expert in death. He wasn't going to get fooled.
So what Sam is saying is, for the live stream again, there is some people think that he was just swooning, that he had just appeared to have died. But the problem with that is centurions are experts in that sort of thing, and they'd know whether or not he had died. So thank you, Sam. All right. We are a bit over time. We're going to talk about the burial itself next time and get to the resurrection, the most wonderful day in the history of the world. Thank you, and we'll start a new live stream in a little bit, so join us for that.